from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. France is the first country to enforce a ban in public on Islamic face veils, or niqabs, causing controversy across the European continent. The law is based on public security grounds, and the majority of French citizens support it, while critics tie it to politics on the part of the Sarkozy administration's attempt to build support on the political right. We'll take the issue up next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The French ban on the niqab, that's the veil for the face that leaves the area around the eyes clear, and also known as a burqa, took effect earlier this week. And in its first enforcement of the ban, French police, who have complained about the difficulties in enforcing the ban, fined a woman in a mall parking lot outside of Paris for wearing a niqab. The fine is 150 euros, but according to the text of the law, the alternative of taking lessons in citizenship is available, and it will be offered to those who violate. It's estimated that out of some 5 million Muslims in France, 2,000 wear the niqab, and we want to take this issue up in this opening Forum hour. Joining us first from Paris is Hélène Foucault, and she is a reporter with the Paris Bureau of Bloomberg News, and we welcome you to the program. Hélène Foucault?
Hello?
Yes, hi.
Yes, hi, hello.
I'm just welcoming you to the program. Let me begin by asking you, what we're reading here is that there's really strong support within the French nation for this ban.
There is indeed a rather big support. I wouldn't say an overwhelming support for the law, but there is a big support in France. And from every side of the political game, actually.
Well, speaking of that political game, those who are critical of the ban are saying it's being done largely by the Sarkozy administration for political gain.
It has been done by Sarkozy. It is actually his brainchild law. I mean, he invented the concept of, you know, banning the burqa. But the French opposition, meaning the Socialist Party, haven't really stood up as one man to say, no, we do not want such a law in France.
The desire for this law to be in place has to do largely with what, France seeing itself as a secular country?
The secular country is, of course, the first thing that the president and his team and most of the people would use to say we do not want to have the burqa in France. It also very much is, in these days, a political game. It's the beginning of the presidential campaign, so targeting the Muslims or targeting one particular part of the population that is a problem for a lot of people in France is a political decision. So this is very much a political game.
And how much does it have to do with the possible candidacy of Marine Le Pen?
Oh, she's getting bigger and stronger in France as every day passes. But the thing that is important with Marine Le Pen is she's actually the first politician who came out to say that she did not want to see any Muslim pray in the streets because there were not enough space in mosques and not enough mosques in France. And she says something about Muslims or about integration in France, and other parties, and namely Sarkozy, would follow. So yes, she has a very big impact on the implementing such a burqa law.
She's now the head of the Front National, which her father had been the head of. And from what we're reading, we should mention that even though she represents a movement toward the right, decidedly toward the right, there isn't as much bigotry or xenophobia as there was identified with her father.
I would say facially, on the facade, she is much less xenophobic than her father. She actually denounced her father's words when her father actually denied the existence of the gas chambers. She said that what her father had said was really bad, and she was not agreeing with her father. But besides that, everything that she might say on Islam, on immigrants, on yes, mainly on Islam and immigrants, is actually really very strong and very negative.
Hélène Foucault, again, is reporter with the Paris Bureau of Bloomberg News, and we thank you so much for joining us on Forum. Appreciate your being with us.
Thank you very much.
We're now going to get a perspective from another reporter, actually an old friend of ours, Frank Browning, who is a writer and journalist, longtime NPR contributor, and who is also joining us from Paris this morning. And Frank, good to have you back here. Welcome.
Yes, nice to talk to you. How you doing?
Okay, let's get your perspective on this. First of all, how much are the police going to be adamant or zealous to support this ban?
Well, that's a difficult question to say because, among other things, they've complained that they don't actually have the right to forcibly remove the veil or the niqab, as the case may be. They're quite different garments. But again, as the previous guest pointed out, this touches deeply into France's sense of minority and majority rights. And the police are caught in the middle here.
Well, indeed, there's been one arrest, and a couple of women I read were arrested outside of Notre Dame Cathedral for unauthorized demonstration, not for wearing the niqab.
That's correct. But what I'd like to suggest here that people should think about, in France, the official line is there are no minorities. Minorities do not exist in France, said the previous interior ministry under Nicolas Sarkozy said exactly that. We don't have minorities here. Well, what does that mean? Under the French Constitution, all citizens, all residents are Republican citizens and are to be taken as the same, which all sounds very well, and they say we don't want to be divided up and balkanized the way American minority politics work. Of course, the fact is there are minorities, Africans or North Africans and Arabs in particular. All you have to do is see who gets stopped at the immigration lines coming into Charles de Gaulle Airport. You know, who do the police stop? 80% of the time, it's people with dark skins. But there are no significant minority rights organizations. In that sense, the burqa has a symbolic effect as a sort of badge of identity, even for those who don't like it. It's worth remembering, probably no more than 10% of France's Muslim population are observant or actual believers. It's about double what the Catholic believing population is.
Many of those who are wearing burqas, as I understand it, are Northern Africans who, in terms of their home country, don't wear the burqa. And in many instances, we've got, second, third generation French citizens who have no immigrant ties, in other words.
That is true, although, again, a documentary filmmaker I talked to several years ago pointed out that a lot of young girls, this is when they were talking about the veil being eliminated in the schools, would, even though they came from secular homes, they put the burqa or the veil on in the school bus or in the streets as an act of rebellion. Now, were they going to continue doing it? I don't know. Their parents didn't want them to do it. But garments, clothing of all sorts, as surely Americans know only too well, serves multiple purposes. And one of those purposes is rebellion from convention. So that happens. The real traditional people who actually, in Britain, for example, and in France, who were more likely to use the burqa, come from Somalia. And there are not that many Somalis in France.
Frank Browning, again, with us from Paris, writer, journalist, longtime NPR contributor. Good to have you with us, Frank. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks.
Let me tell you who else is with us. For the hour, Phyllis Chesler, emerita professor of psychology and women's studies at the City University of New York. She's written 15 books, including Women in Madness and Woman's Inhumanity to Woman, and has been asked to submit expert affidavits on behalf of Asylum for Women attempting to escape from being honor murdered. She was last with us in a very spirited debate with Robert Bly, if some listeners recall. Phyllis Chesler, good to have you on Forum.
Nice to be with you.
We also have with us this morning Merve Kavachik-Zlam, who is a lecturer with the International Relations Department at George Washington University, author of a book called Headscarf Politics in Turkey, a Postcolonial Reading, and a former member of the Turkish Parliament. And she joins us from the nation's capital, and we welcome you to the program this morning.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Glad to have you. Let me begin, if I may, with Phyllis Chesler and hear the pro side of the ban. Many wouldn't expect Phyllis Chesler, a longtime feminist, to be in favor of this ban because it has been identified by people who are against it as being, well, anti-feminist, don't let the states rule in determining what women wear on their body, all of that sort of thing. But I read your article with great interest, Phyllis Chesler, and essentially you're saying this is misogynistic and it's also putting people at risk.
Yes. Women in the West, girls and women, have been honor-murdered and seriously beaten when they refuse to veil properly. And let me make some very important points. We are not talking about the headscarf or hijab. The French law, the ban, is religion and ethnicity neutral. It doesn't mention Islam, only face covering. And as a feminist, as a very long-time feminist leader, I'm very aware of the tricky nature of bringing the state into decisions about what women wear or what women do or how women worship. But I also think that a new kind of colonialism is afoot when we abandon our original concept of universal rights for all. So that's let them, the Muslim women, eat cake in the West. Let them be veiled because they've been misinformed as to, and I'm talking now, I once lived in Kabul, Afghanistan, and I've lived in the Islamic world. If you put on a burqa or a Saudi version, an Afghan version, you can't breathe. You begin to feel claustrophobic. You have no peripheral vision. If you get used to it as a way of life, it seriously affects your psychology, your self-esteem, your sense of independence, and you have vitamin D sunlight deprivation deficiency diseases. So in the West, when we are saying, oh, well, if we're going to be religiously tolerant, even though it's not a requirement to face veil in Islam, if we're going to be religiously tolerant and even feminist, then we have to allow this multicultural expression. And I say as a feminist, why are only the women bearing the flagship of the honor or dignity of Islam and not the men? The men who walk by their sides are dressed in modern clothing.
Well, you also say that there's a security issue here.
Well, there is, but it's not my main point. The security issue has to do with hiding weapons under a big flowing burqa, which you might be able to do under a big flowing trench coat, and or men dressing as women to blow themselves or others up. I don't know how this happens all over the Arab Middle East, that's for sure.
Well, you also, I think, in your article, getting back to the feminist side of things or the feminist argument, you say that there's a sense in the Arab world, particularly with the resurgence of the veil and the burqa, of identifying those who wear them as being good and those who don't as being essentially bad and fair game.
Absolutely correct. Although veiled women have been assaulted by rampaging mobs in Cairo on Friday after a mosque sermon because the men were fired up. And there's been a wilding incident, so that wearing the veil doesn't necessarily protect a woman at home from being beaten or honor-murdered or in every way treated like a beast of burden and a subhuman. And on the street, it may to some extent protect her, but then not totally. And it then endangers all those many, many Muslim women with a long history of going about naked-faced, dressed in modern clothing for nearly more than 75 years in Egypt, Morocco, Tunisia, Iran, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, and actually even for a brief period in Afghanistan, the only country where women have remained totally face-veiled in the sweltering heat, wearing heavy black garments, is Saudi Arabia. So there's a very long history of Muslim religious figures saying this is not religiously required.
Forgive me, but in fact, in your article, and this was something that surprised me, there have actually been fatwas against the wearing of burqas.
Well, interestingly enough, in 2009, Sheikh Mohammed Said Tantawi, the Grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar University, which is Sunni Islam's highest institution of religious learning, got very angry when he toured a high school in Cairo and he found a no doubt terrified teenager wearing a face veil. And he said the niqab is a tradition. It has no connection to religion. And he instructed her never again to wear the niqab again. And he issued a fatwa, which is a religious edict, against its use in school.
Wasn't there another sheikh who said that only the prophet's wives were supposed to have worn this?
Absolutely. There are many. And there's very recently, just the other day, the imam of the Oxford Islamic congregation on April 12th congratulated Sarkozy for his law and said the decision, his name is Dr. Taj Hargay, the decision by the French government to outlaw all forms of public face masking, including the burqa and niqab, again, I must stress it's not hijab or headscarf, is welcomed by all thinking Muslims around the world. The problem with the face veil, and especially with the full face veil, the burqa and the body covering, is it is a sensory deprivation isolation chamber. So imagine if your judge is wearing a burqa, or if a witness testifying in a courtroom is wearing a burqa, if your doctor or your nurse working in a hospital is wearing a burqa and will carry superbugs from patient to patient. It is not the friendliest face of Islam in the West. One can dress modestly. The Quran mandates for both men and women modest dress and even head covering without setting oneself apart in so removed a fashion.
Phyllis Chesler again with us from New York, Emerita Professor of Psychology and Women's Studies at City University of New York. Let's go to our other guest here, Merve Kavach Islam, who is a lecturer in international relations at George Washington University and author of Headscarf Politics in Turkey, a Postcolonial Reading. She's also a former member of the Turkish Parliament. The notion, first of all, that this is a humanitarian issue from your perspective, Merve Kavach Islam, how much do you see this as being really valid, as Phyllis Chesler presents it?
I respect what I heard from the emeritus professor, but where shall I start to sort of refute some of the arguments that are very much entrenched in these Orientalist assumptions? Indeed, we need to separate between what a veil is, that is the face covering, the burqa, as the international world goes in Afghani language, unfortunately, today, and a headscarf. Headscarf, the covering of Muslim women, is not exceptional to Islam. And indeed, to the very opposite of the argument that was just suggested by the professor emeritus, it is religiously required for Muslim women to cover themselves. Actually, it is religiously required for Christian and Jewish women who come from the other two Abrahamic religions to cover themselves as well. And there is a minority group of scholars in Islam who argue that the covering of the hair is not actually included in that covering of modesty, but that's just a minority view. So I personally find it to be a mandate on myself by God to cover myself. That's why I choose to cover, even if it was at the expense of being thrown out of the Turkish parliament when I wanted to take my oath of office.
But this does not. Include.
Let me just ask.
About the covering of the face, though. We're distinguishing that because that's the ban in France right now.
Indeed. Well, but we know that French laïcité is very different than the separation of church and state and secularism as we understand in this part of the world, in United States of America. The French case includes control of religion and even controlling religion to the extent that it can affect your life in the private realm, not just the public realm. A few years ago, we talked about the ostentatious religious symbols ban that French system has brought onto students just to ostracize the Muslim girls from schools, including, of course, the Jewish students and the Hindu students wearing Sikhs were also part of that process as well, but we all knew that. The target was the Muslim students at public schools in France. And actually, I want to bring to your attention the very fact that in Paris, a few weeks ago, at the region of Saint-Denis, a district of Paris, four Muslim students were given a warning by their schools because their skirts were too long, and that actually threatened the French laïcité. So where are we going to end this control or intrusion by the state over people's religious freedoms? I do not wear a veil, face veil, but I definitely respect women who choose to wear one. I also acknowledge the very fact that there are women out there throughout the world who might be wearing something or who might be forced to wearing something against their free will, be a Muslim woman or a non-Muslim woman. And I understand that. But my point here is, what do we do about, to what extent do we have the right as the state or as people per se, as institutions per se, to intervene with Muslim women who are taking an action with their own free will?
And when the French argue that this is a security issue, you say what to that?
What I say to that, that is a reasonable argument. But indeed, the state that poses this argument is also responsible to take the necessary measures to bring in a female police officers where these women can lift their veils off and they can see their faces. Indeed, the professor emeritus also pointed out that this is not really the matter. You can cover yourself with something else, with a long coat or a trench coat as a man or a woman, without a headscarf or a veil, and still blow yourself up. I think this is a populistic approach on part of Sarkozy. Actually, what I think lies at the very bottom of this are two things. One of them actually is seen in the very argument stated within the law. The current law in France that we are discussing talks about a fine of 150 euros and or a citizenship course. The second part, the latter part, is what I'm interested in. The French women, the French Muslim women who choose to wear a veil must be taught how to be French. This is about the construction of national French identity. So in order to be a good citizen, a French, you must be you must abide by certain rules and regulations, and some of these rules are unsung rules.
Now you heard Frank Browning say that according to French dictum, minorities do not exist.
Oh, indeed. Well, I think this is a way of creating a minority. We're talking about third, at times fourth generation of a Muslim population who consider themselves not just Muslims, but French as well at the very same time. That's where the system, the French system, is enduring this dilemma and quandary. And at the very bottom of this, we see what I would call the second item that comes out as an overarching reason behind all of this, the Orientalist assumptions that are very much entrenched in European culture, if you will, but more so in French laïcité. We endure the same problem in Turkey because we have important French laïcité and called it laïklik in Turkey, the separation of church and state. To the extent that the state finds it fit, finds itself responsible to intrude with religious affairs.
Excuse me, I'm coming up on a break here, and I do want to invite listeners to join this discussion. We're also going to talk to a young woman in Berkeley who wears the hijab, the niqab. If you have something you'd like to say or ask, join us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786 as we continue our discussion. Again, we welcome your phone calls, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. The number to call, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. When we return, we'll hear from you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The French ban on the niqab, the face-covering Islamic veil, also known as the burqa, took effect earlier this week. And now, in a first enforcement of the ban, French police have fined a woman in a mall parking lot outside of Paris for wearing a niqab. We're discussing this divisive issue. We spoke earlier with Hélène Foucault, who is a reporter with the Paris Bureau of Bloomberg News, and with Frank Browning, writer and journalist and longtime National Public Radio contributor. And with us for the hour is Phyllis Chesler, Emerita Professor of Psychology and Women's Studies at City University of New York and author of many books, including Women in Madness, and Merve Kavachid Islam, who is a lecturer in international relations at George Washington University, author of Headscarf Politics in Turkey, a postcolonial reading, and also a former member of the Turkish parliament. We want to bring into this discussion a young woman named Imana. That's not her real name. It's a name that she is using here. She's a Berkeley resident who wears the niqab, the face covering veil, and want to get her perspective as well. And we welcome you to the program. Good morning to you.
Hello. Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. Let me just ask you first to explain why you wear the niqab.
Okay. I chose to wear the niqab because I feel like it helps me interact with the world, with excluding the physical aspects, where I can present my mind and my opinions and beliefs without having physical aspects interfering.
So it's personal rather than religious?
Well, I mean, it's both. I think as being a Muslim, I have the option of doing so. It is presented as an option. And
I'm sorry, presented by whom as an option?
In the religion. It's an option that we can choose. I mean, modesty is definite. It's an obligation, whereas the level to which extent you choose your level of modesty, you know, as far as whether you have your face and hands exposed or you want to cover them, you can also do that.
Modesty as opposed to piety or piety as well?
Well, of course, piety is the most important, but modesty is a fruit of piety.
I mentioned piety specifically because it's not one of the five pillars of Islam, and certainly we've been hearing about the psychological effects and the concern about that, but that just is the opposite in your case. In fact, it makes you more psychologically free not to be in the physical aspects that you have wanted to exclude?
Yeah, I believe it does. I mean, I think growing up in the West, where women are in a lot of ways judged according to their physical appearance, and they will in turn judge themselves according to their physical appearance, you know, it's empowering to decide that I'm going to exclude my physical appearance from the outer spectrum.
Empowers you in what way? That's a word that's often used by feminists, and I'm curious to hear it from you. How does it empower you?
Like as I said, that when I exit my house, I'm presenting only my beliefs and my morals and my thoughts and opinions to the world, and I don't have to spend time in the mirror trying to look a certain way or be concerned with how physically appealing I am to the outer public.
It doesn't objectify you as a woman, in other words.
I don't believe so at all.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your being with us.
Thank you.
It's Imana, a Berkeley resident who wears the niqab. We're going to go to your calls and emails. I believe, Phyllis Chesler, you wanted to say
yes,
something here first.
I wanted to make some very quick points. I think this is a very valid avoidance of being a sex object. The difference is that nobody in the West, I'm not being forced to wear a bikini, and I'm not being punished or killed if I refuse to do so. So the face veil may, in the West, indeed remove a woman, understandably, from catcalls and harassment on the street. I wish that the men would learn to look down. However, this is the point I wanted to make, 2 points, that the peer pressure in the Islamic world for women to now wear burqa and niqab is off the charts. So that, for example, there's in a newspaper, Raz Al Youssef, in Egypt, somebody is writing about how if she doesn't wear a hijab, if she doesn't wear niqab, she's guilty until proven innocent by all the neighbors and on the street, and she doesn't want to have to waste her time proving that she really is a respectable and educated girl, even if she's naked-faced. And then the author tells Suha's story, somebody who comes from a prominent Egyptian family, and she keeps losing one marriage proposal after another because she refuses to promise that she will wear hijab and stop working after marriage. Very often, not always, but very often, wearing hijab and or niqab and definitely burqa means that one is obedient in many things, including you accept a marriage proposal from your first cousin, you never seek a divorce even if you're badly beaten, you won't work outside the home, so that there is a good deal of peer pressure now and some intimidation and even of a terrorist nature domestically on having women feel that for them to be proper Muslims, the right kind of girls, that they must veil.
But let's talk for just a moment, if we could, about, and then I want to get a response from Marve Kavach Islam and also get our listeners involved in this. But here in the United States, there's much more of an attitude of tolerance. In fact, I think you pointed out in your article, Hillary Clinton and Nancy Pelosi both wore hijabs while they were visiting Muslim and Arab countries. So did, for that matter, did Prime Minister Caroline Spelman. Prime Minister, I want to call her Prime Minister because she's not, British Minister Caroline Spelman. The sense is, in other words, that there ought to be an openness, that this is about religious freedom, that if this young woman, for example, wants to wear a veil and wear a burqa, that's her option.
Well, I wish that there was real religious reciprocity, because one cannot practice Christianity or Judaism in Saudi Arabia. Christian minorities are seriously persecuted and being massacred all over the Muslim world, and yet you have Muslim immigrants and third and fourth generation Muslims who are demanding the right to practice what we may view as misogyny that is barbaric, that they are claiming is their form of worship, and we in the West are committed to being religiously tolerant. So the question for the West is, well, okay, but then how do we protect those girls and women who are being beaten and or honor-murdered for refusing to veil, or for refusing to marry first cousins, or refusing to stay in abusive marriages? So does the state have an interest in the West in passing laws and in protecting Muslim and immigrant girls and women in a way that we can't do in Muslim-majority countries?
All right, let me hold that thought and go to Merve Kavach Islam and get your response to some of what's been said here, if I could.
Indeed. Unfortunately, I have to say, Professor Emeritus is approaching to the Muslim world from this condescending attitude that the Muslim people are in need of help of the white Western world. I see the very sort of imperialist neo-colonial tendencies, a subtle message in there as well. And these are the playouts of the Orientalist assumptions. In the Western world, we're not able to, but more so in Europe, not in the United States of America, but in Europe, the Orientalist assumptions are so much entrenched that we fail to understand how in the world a woman would ever want to cover herself. You can see this very clearly in the European Court of Human Rights decisions at Strasbourg, the cases that are taken against women with headscarves or veils in Europe or in Turkey and some parts of the Muslim world who appeal to the court. If we are going to talk about human rights violations against women, against Muslim women, we also must talk about human rights violations against women, period. We cannot say that everything that happens in the Muslim world has to do with the perception of religion or certain construes of religion. And indeed, I do accept very much. I acknowledge the fact that there are women out there who have to wear something against their own free will. But there are a lot of women who are oppressed in this very part of the world as well. We need to, if we are going to extend a helping hand to some women, we must do that equally. I must say that the vitamin D discussion that came earlier by the professor emeritus, the deficiency because women are so much covered can be refuted with the argument that Muslim women who cover themselves do not suffer from skin cancer. I had written a book on this. My dissertation was on this. So please do understand that. There's no direct connection that is supported.
You don't have vitamin D deficiency if you're not getting sunlight?
There is no direct connection between the wearing, covering of yourself because of your religious reasons and a vitamin D deficiency. Right.
Let me just jump in here because we do have a lot of people who want to join the conversation. I want to give them an opportunity. In fact, let me just read a few emails before I go to your calls. This is Christine who says, I think this law in France is insane. If they ban burqas in the name of secularism, shouldn't they ban wearing crosses or yarmulkes? Another listener, Jim, says, my understanding is that the burqa and similar face veils are cultural, not religious, or at least not specifically Muslim. I also understand that much of the Quran that addresses harsh treatment of women carries over from the Torah, the Old Testament, my point being that Islam isn't unique in its misogynistic texts. And some web comments. Listener writes, Michael, this is a tricky issue, but I wonder when we have these discussions why we seem so hard on the West and don't make side-by-side comparisons of other countries. So now the legal dress code in France doesn't permit burqas. Isn't an international view worthwhile, too? Women must wear certain clothing in Saudi Arabia and Iran. Men can't wear certain hats in Turkey, etc. Having a national dress code doesn't sound too extreme in France compared to other parts of the world where the burqa and similar dress is the norm. If the West shouldn't ban certain dress, how can many other countries get away with little self-criticism? And a listener named Poppy says, regarding head coverings for religious or ethnic purposes, does France ban the nun's habit too? Let's go to our callers, and we'll begin with Matt. You're on. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. I was just listening to both your callers. I think, or both your speakers. I think they both answered my question. My question is, you know, if women are required to wear burqas and, you know, face veils, why is it not acceptable for, you know, Westerners to go to their country and dress freely as they please without fear of being attacked with violence? I mean, I find it outrageous that someone can't express themselves in their country without being attacked and have violence perpetrated against them. It's just, it comes down to tolerance. And unfortunately, it appears to me that the fundamentalists are the ones who get all the press, and they're the ones who are drowning out the moderates, and it will be to the moderates and the Middle East demise if the extremists are the ones to prevail. And that's my comment.
All right, we thank you for that point. Actually, Merv Kavakaj Islam, let me put this another way from what the caller just said. There is an argument which I'm sure you've heard that, well, we've heard your argument about Orientalism, the Edward Said word about condescension and so forth of the West. But the other side of it says that Muslim countries are very intolerant, some of them, of short skirts or things of this nature that are more identified perhaps with Western habits. And there's a great deal of anger and even violence toward that kind of clothing.
Well, I think, again, first, please do not interrupt me if you invited me to this program. We all have better things to do and more important things to do, but I'm here speaking, and I will appreciate if you do not cut me off.
I have to serve as a moderator, and I have to move things along. I want you to please appreciate and understand that. If I interrupt you, it's not out of discourtesy.
To Professor Emeritus, I will appreciate if you can allocate me the same kind of time. I just gave you an example from Paris where students, skirt length was an issue in French schools. That's the French Western Christian country where Muslim students are not allowed to wear a skirt as long as, I don't know, that they feel comfortable. If we are going to make any generalizations, we have to do that for the Western world, and which is a danger. As an academic, we always advise our students not to hold on to generalizations. Indeed, there might be attitudes in Muslim world that might ostracize foreigners or people of other faiths, but that is also valid in the Western world as well against the Muslim people. In my own home country, Turkey, the Muslim population, the Muslim women who dress who wear a headscarf are marginalized by the Muslim state itself. Where are we going to draw a line in between personal freedoms and choices and states' intrusion, I think is the question. And all stories have two sides, and all medallions have two sides. So we can go on and on talking about some sporadic, very individualistic cases where someone was harassed in a Muslim country, and then we can talk about the many of the harassments that some other people from other lands might have endured in this part of the world.
Right, I'm not interrupting you. I'm moving the program along. Phyllis Chesler.
I wanted to address the Orientalism as a concept. First, I recommend Ibn Warraq's excellent book on Edward Said, who told many lies that were quickly picked up. We must understand that just as the West has a history of imperialism and colonialism and slavery, Islam has an even bigger history of imperialism, colonialism, and slavery, including white slavery and sex slavery, which continues to this day, and that the largest practitioner of apartheid in the world today is Islam in terms of both gender apartheid and religious apartheid. And we've been talking about religious apartheid. And for 40 years, I have certainly criticized the West in terms of sexism, and I continue to do so. And I think what is new is the failure of many second-wave feminists to continue our universalist concept and analysis of sexism to apply to Muslim-majority countries, because we're afraid we will be called racists, we will be called Orientalists, which is now more important among the intelligentsia in the West than our human rights for journalists who are being tortured and murdered in prison cells all over the Islamic world, homosexuals who are being murdered for being homosexuals, feminists, activists all over the Muslim world who are fighting for the truth and for freedom, and indeed also for the right not to have to veil and not to be pressured into it.
All right, Phyllis Chesler, I'm not interrupting you either, but I do have a lot of callers here, and I have to move the program along, and let me get another caller on, and that's Susan. Thank you for waiting, Susan. You're on.
Yes, thank you. I'm a psychologist living in Santa Rosa area, and I, for the first time, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I saw a woman wearing a hijab, a niqab. I'm not sure the difference, but I had an extremely bad reaction to it. It was an 85-degree day. Her husband, I assume, was with her, wearing a very lightweight tunic kind of a thing. And she had this extremely heavy-looking outfit on. And I saw that, and I'm very much of a proponent of civil rights and religious rights, but I saw this as sexist. I saw this as abusive of this woman who is being forced, possibly, into wearing this outrageously heavy outfit on a very hot day.
All right. I thank you for your call. I want to get a number of callers on here because we have a lot of people who really want to weigh in here and want to hear what you have to say. Our next caller is Shailendra. Do I have your name right, Shailendra?
Yes, you do.
Yes, please join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I live and work in the Santa Clara area right now, but I'm an Indian citizen. And I think it's just a lot of hypocrisy in the Western world in terms of secularism. I don't see how you can ban the hijab or the veil in different ways it's called, because it's cultural, it's also religious, and it doesn't necessarily mean that there is an extreme element to women that wear it. For example, in my country, there are about 150 million Muslims who are free to do whatever they want, and nobody forces them to wear or not wear something. To give you an example, our president, who is a female, Pratibha Patil, she's a Hindu, and she always covers her head, and that doesn't mean that she's an extremist. It's just that's just what she wants to do, and it's her personal choice.
All right, sir. I thank you for the call. A couple more emails to read here. A comment on the web. What speak? I do not wear a veil, but many of my family do. And what the speaker is saying about the West looking from the outside and giving the verdict, I wonder if the same speaker will talk about the evils of wearing dresses, which expose every inch of the body. Evil is not in covering, but not covering yourself. Mary, the mother of Jesus, is always shown fully covered. Another listener says, although I don't think I have the right to say what is right and wrong in foreign countries, I believe the French law is correct. It is an aid to prevent ethnocentrism and promote a unified France where all citizens there are French first. This is, in my opinion, a downfall for the United States where they promote ethnocentrism. You as a U.S. citizen are second to whatever ethnic group you belong to. That's from Rick. From Kevin, I find it ironic and hypocritical that your Turkish guest talks about religious freedoms, yet Christians in the Middle East are discriminated against constantly. Examples of this can be seen in Egypt with the Coptic Christians fighting for equality, and in Turkey where Armenians have been systematically killed and discriminated against because of their beliefs, even until now with the murder of an Armenian journalist. It seems like tolerance needs to be exercised on both sides for the rhetoric to calm down. Let me go to another caller. Yusef, you're on.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Good morning to your guests. And so, aside from the point that the comparison between the West and the East and the fact and numbers show that the immigration is for religious freedoms and political freedoms and civil rights are happening from the Muslim countries towards the West and not vice versa, I'd like also to point that given that the burqa is not a religious matter, since Islam does not recommend it or suggest it or talks about it, and that the Quran itself teaches to be a middle nation, I think we should take in consideration the French context. In saying that France is not the U.S., there is a large Muslim population in France that is not the same as in the U.S. Also, taking in consideration that the burqa has a political connotation, given that it's an Afghani / Saudi Wahhabi extremist political movement, it is part of it, and I think. Also, factoring in the security issue in terms of identification of the face in banks and public institutions, this is clearly not Islamophobia. This is clearly not against Islam. It's against extremism, Wahhabism, and a political agenda that has an objective. And it's also about security. And so we shouldn't be talking about Islam and Islamophobia at all. As a Muslim, I don't consider this an Islamophobic ban at all.
All right.
I mean, I don't consider it a ban against Islam at all. As a Muslim, I'm very comfortable with this ban. It does not target me, does not target my wife, nor my religion. It is clearly a security issue and a political issue that I and most of the Muslim world is against, i.e. Wahhabism, extremism, Talibanism, that is to say.
All right, Yusef, let me thank you for the call and for your opinion. And let me go back to Merv Kavaki Islam and get a response to it being largely political and security.
We acknowledged already that if there is a security matter to it, it is the state's responsibility to take the necessary measures to lift it from the security realm, and this is doable. I see this more of a populistic approach from Sarkozy's declining numbers of popularity, for one thing, because burqa, the veil, the face veil, is irrelevant to the French context since less than 1% of the Muslim women in France wear the burqa. Why now, when there are constant elections in France and Sarkozy is not doing well and therefore has to prod and guard the very jingoistic rightist population constituents for the upcoming elections? But I have to say some things about the comments made already. A female caller talked about outrageous covering of Muslim women. Let me tell you what might be also outrageous from another perspective. The immorality that goes around in Western societies is outrageous. Early pregnancy pregnancy, extramarital affairs that climb up our political system here in Washington, D.C. is what is outrageous. So we can talk about these on and on. And at the end, the question is, who will be the judge of what is outrageous, what is modesty, and what is not? I think women have to be left alone to themselves, be in the West or the East, to whatever lifestyle they choose. As a response to the caller about Armenian journalists killing in Turkey, actually, the deep state, which embraced the very Kemalist ideology of sequestering and oppressing the religion of Islam for Muslims of Turkey, killed the Armenian journalist in Turkey, not the Muslims. So let's put the context right. I think this is very critical.
Right, and once again,
this is not a sign of rebellion. Women choose to wear their scarves, their headscarves, their shawls, their veils, or their burqas, and power to them, I say, because it is not my place to tell them what to wear or not to wear.
All right, once again, I'm not interrupting you, but I want to go back to Phyllis Chesler and get her response to some of the comments that have made.
Okay. Very quickly, immorality exists in the West and in the Muslim-majority countries. Women are raped in Muslim countries. They are raped here. The difference, women are honor-murdered in Muslim countries. They are honor-murdered here. There is a difference. We in the West have now called these crimes. We do not glorify, nor do we hide, nor do we justify the perpetrators of such crimes, which include incest and wife beating and daughter beating in Muslim majority countries mainly. The problem is that at least we've made some headway. We've evolved in the West to begin to name what is a crime and to prevent it and or prosecute it or both. This has yet to happen in Muslim-majority countries, where it is considered shameful and hidden to expose. It is not discussed. So immorality, I mean, I'm from that second-wave generation of feminists that talked about the too-short skirt and the sex objectification of women, but I don't think that the opposite extreme, putting bags over women's heads, faces, and bodies, is then the corrective.
I'm afraid that's going to have to be the final word. I appreciate the participation of both of you, and I think this has been a spirited and, I hope, enlightening debate. Phyllis Chesler, again, is Emerita Professor of Psychology and Women's Studies at City University of New York, author of Women in Madness and Women's Inhumanity to Woman, and Merve Kavachi Islam is a lecturer in international relations at George Washington University, author of Headscarf Politics in Turkey, a Postcolonial Reading, and a former member of the Turkish Parliament. Want to also extend thanks to Uma Mina, who joined us, a Berkeley resident who wears the niqab, and also to Frank Browning and Elaine Fouquet, who both joined us from Paris. Alain Fouquet with Bloomberg News and Frank Browning with NPR. And thank you, our listeners. We would not be here without you and appreciate your listenership. We're here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And another hour of Forum coming up. We're going to talk about this controversial book by Joseph Lelyfeld on Gandhi in the hour ahead. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.